Experimental program.
As far as I'm concerned, there's just don't
Shall we begin?
Yeah.
Now, what would have been really amazing is if the text had gone through.
Slightly translucent.
Well, you're facing this way. How do you know it didn't?
Absolutely. Sound guy has to check.
The focal point of the base.
You need a microphone.
All that stuff is adjustable to the end. Yeah, so you can dial in virtually any kind of read things.
Hi, Dan.
No, we're having a lecture.
Oh, okay. On the ins and outs of line arrays?
Yeah.
All right.
Cell phones up.
Oh. Cell phones on stun?
All right.
I wanted to put it on the
Well, welcome.
It's our May meeting.
There's one more meeting to go for the calendar year. I'm Rick Chin, if you didn't know. I'm the section chair, at least for another meeting. Then I'm going to pass the baton. So let's see. Having said that, let's do the audience introductions. So we'll start here. And please tell the group who you are and your connection with audio.
Tom Monahan. A lot of different connections to audio, but currently not working in the industry. I work for Starbucks.
Mike Metesky, member of the AES Program Committee, owner of Opus 4 Studios, member of Opus 4, member of performing ensembles. We also have a music publishing business.
Dave Tostylane, I'm chair of performance production at Cornish College of the Arts and ADS member, lighting designer and sound designer.
Jake Bryan, also on the committee, and I teach here at the Art Institute, and I'm master at RFI.
Adam Jenkins, I work at, I'm an acoustician at the Greenbush Group and a hobbyist audio nerd geek, whatever the appropriate term is.
I'm Lindsay Smith. I also work at Greenbush, and I design sound and video systems for buildings and do some occasional other things.
Mark Edmond. I call myself Audio Jewel. I design and build high-performance loudspeakers. I've been saying for the home, but since I've showed them around the AES here, I've heard the word mastering monitor, so whatever you want.
Steve Turnage. Aris Davina, mastering engineer, also do circuit board design. I'm working for doing some stuff for Open Labs right now, which is fun. And I'm right now on horrible deadline building a device that has a lot of lights and blinky things for a two-year-old, the son of the lead singer for Information Society. It's very strange. Evidently, he's very, very enamored with buttons and knobs and lights, and he wanted to have him stop reprogramming the phone answering machine. So this is due on Friday, and it's like only 3 or 4 days worth of work left.
Ouch.
You can do it.
I know.
George Gilman, primarily independent software engineer right now, part-time musician, music geek.
I'm Bob Smith. By day, I work at Physio Control as an acoustic researcher, and at night, I run PS Studios.
Fernando Labarte, fifth quarter audio student here at the Art Institute of Seattle.
Adam Morris, and I'm a first quarter student here in the audio program.
Jake Ryan, and I'm a first quarter student.
I'm a third quarter student.
Rick Sparkowski, I run a small company called Integrated Light and Sound, and
I also work at Seattle Center as a sound tech, and also work at the Monroe Hall as a sound tech, and also do stage and lighting and rigging.
Melissa Weaver, third quarter student here at AIS.
Janie Wallach, I record live music, and if anybody wants to help me out at Folk Life this weekend, please look me up and tell me tonight, okay?
This weekend?
Yes.
I'll come down and watch it. Bob Gudgel, I'm on the AES committee and worked at a few audio companies around town in the past years, except for the past 17, 18 years of doing electronic design for renewable energy stuff. And when I was a kid, my dad made, he was a TV repairman at TV shops, and he made me a buzz box. And it was a box with all sorts of buttons and knobs and lights, and didn't have circuit boards. You know, on those, but it probably kept me out. He tried probably to keep me out of, you know, taking apart a TV set, you know, everything in sight.
My name is Rob Baum. I'm an audio engineer. I specialize in test and measurement, and I work for a couple of pro companies, consulting companies, and actually for CBS Records, that was my first job, making those black discs, if maybe you don't know, because you're too dumb. That was my first job.
Wow, the actual blanks, the whole pressing,
records, yeah.
The, how it's made on the Science Channel just yesterday or the day before had a thing on.
It's an interesting process, but it's obsolete
now. Right, a lot of people sell lots of vinyl.
Long live vinyl.
I'm Bill Gibson. I work with the audio production program here at the Art Institute of Seattle and in career services. So if anybody needs interns or eager young employees, I'm here for you.
I'm Steve Arsati. I'm the director of the audio program here at the Institute. And I'm just happy to have you guys come down and be with us.
I'm Matthew Gephardt. I'm a recording engineer. I primarily work at Sage Arts Recording Studio in Arlington, Washington. And I record for Steve Eagle.
And you're an AIS graduate.
Yes, I am. About 10 years ago.
Which quarter is that?
They give out grades here?
Dan Mortensen, I do live sound for concerts and stuff, and I'm on the committee, and I've learned a lot about the speaker placement and libraries in the last year.
I'm Julian Martlew. I'm an instructor here at AIS. I'm also a front of house sound for On the Boards Theater in Queen Anne, and I do live mixing and ISD and broadcast for KEXP.
Phil Schultz, I'm an audio visual systems engineer.
I'm Steve Dixon, I work for Boeing, and I'm a student at the Art Institute here, but I only take a couple classes at a time, so God only knows what quarter I'm actually in. Only Steve knows.
Fifth quarter.
Yeah. That's about right numerically.
And I'm Pam Goad. I'm the Dean of Academic Affairs here. I work with Steve. We're partners together in this environment. And I was a member of the chapter about 15 years ago, and I'm embarrassed to say that Rick Chin has aged better than I have. Which is when I first met him long ago. He doesn't remember me.
You should see that oil painting he's got in the closet.
Yeah. It's really bad. Okay, now see. Oh, Yvonne?
I'm Yvonne Dasher. For we work for Microsoft doing audio. New audio algorithms hopefully make Windows to sound better, to capture sounds better, and a member of the AIS committee here.
Let's see, we got everybody? Yes? Okay. I need to do the member count. So if you're a member, please hold your hand up.
Of Audio Engineering Society.
I count 13.
Did you count yourself?
14.
You didn't have up all that well.
Okay, June meeting. The June meeting was
Our guest for June was supposed to be this month, but we did a quick shuffle and moved it to June, and June 9th, which is actually pretty soon, and it'll be up at Opus 4, and it'll be an evening with Frank Lyko, who, if you don't know, was a longtime engineer at CBS Records, 30th Street Studio in New York. Did a lot of old sessions in the 50s and 60s and 70s. A lot of big orchestra needs. What else? Okay, June also brings elections with it. And the people running for election are Steve Turnage for chair. I'm switching places with him and running for vice chair.
Assuming we get the votes.
Yeah.
We can't be too presumptive.
Right. Gary Louie is running for secretary again. Dave Francois running for treasurer. And then on the committee, we have Rob Baum. And Rob is new, so don't think that the committee is just a closed club. We welcome newcomers. Let's see, Kevin Jablonski, who's
also an
attorney and an AIS grad, oddly enough. J.J. Johnston, Mark Rogers, and Yvonne are running for the committee. There's nobody is running opposed, so everybody wins.
Assuming we get the votes.
Yes. Assuming we have a quorum in the June meeting. So if you're a member, please attend the June meeting.
For ourselves.
Yes. Yes, Rick.
Is there a point where you open for nomination for any of them?
Yes. Now.
Okay. I just want to make sure that happens, so in case anybody wants to nominate somebody.
Oh, yeah. Actually, it's been open since, let's see, March or April.
And any time between now and then.
Yes.
To nominate yourself that night.
You must right. be a member to run.
Yes.
Or be willing to join.
We'll overlook the member now for a member later. Let's see.
We have another person that just came in. Steve just walked in.
So. Oh.
For introduction.
Steve McAtee, Ray Corporation.
You're an ATS member, aren't you?
I am.
15. Okay.
And he could run.
He could.
We did introductions, but
yeah.
Should we nominate him since he was late?
Let's nominate him.
So,
I didn't bring my sneakers. Oh.
Or you can sneak kind of sneak in and carry on. Borrow mine if you don't have basketball pair feet. Okay, and one other thing, I'm going to plead for your votes because I've been nominated for national office.
Woo!
To be the Western Regional Vice President. So that's currently Bob Lee's job, and he's been nominated to be the secretary, taking Ron Stryker's job. And I think Ron's going to ride off into the sunset. Now, that said, I am not running unopposed, unfortunately. my opponent is Dr. Sean Olive from Harmon, who I consider a formidable candidate. So I could use your votes, please. Okay, that said, we'll get to our meeting.
How do they go about voting?
You get a letter or email.
You'll get email or a printed ballot from the society.
In July or something, June?
Something like that. June, July, I don't recall. But when you get it, please do something about it. Okay, our featured speaker tonight is Mark Rogers, a member of the committee for I don't know how many years. Mark is director of the AV department at the Greenbush Group. He's a designer of audiovisual systems, including sound reinforcement, audio reproduction, video projection and displays, video conferencing and audio conferencing, and related control systems. Typical projects include corporate boardrooms, convention centers, universities, and hospitals. What, an occasional penal institution?
In the past, I no longer admit to doing anything in the detention environment. Those have interesting problems, too.
Yeah.
They probably most of the acoustical problems there are political.
They probably bring new meaning to the words reliability also.
They do that as well.
Mark has designed and installed AV for over 30 years and teaches classes and seminars on AV technology. He's a registered professional engineer in Idaho and earned his BSCE at the University of Idaho. He's a past vice chair of the section and a current committee member and has presented several topics to the section. So, without further ado, Mark Rogers.
About
if we can get the computer to wake up, we will. I think this thing has crashed.
Of course.
We're going to talk a little bit about architectural acoustics with a bent for audio people. This talk is normally 8 hours long, so I've had to truncate a few things, and we're off to a rip-roaring start here. No soap. It's really crashed. I can't even control Alt Delete. Well, we'll hit the power switch and reboot. Yeah. Can't get any mouse action.
Very much.
He was just running through the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't know. It's either Microsoft or Hewlett Packard. Can't possibly be my software. Let's see if I can remember what the first slide says. There are basically four things that we think have to do with acoustics, at least in our practice. One is room acoustics, which is what you probably think we're going to talk about tonight. Two is transmission loss or isolation. In other words, I have sound in here. I don't want it going out there in the hall, and perhaps vice versa. I don't want the people in the hall to disturb the class. Three is HVAC noise control, or actually noise and vibration control in general, which for the most part has to do with HVAC systems, mechanical systems, although not always. Sometimes there are other things that have to be dealt with. And four is the design of the electronic part of acoustics, in other words, the sound system itself. But we're not going to talk about that tonight. We assume you probably already know a little something about that. So we'll talk a little bit about those first three topics. Actually, most of the talk will be centered on room acoustics, and then after the break I'm going to whiz through some slides on noise control, noise and vibration control, and a little bit about isolation. Does anybody remember when we had 6 megahertz PCs that ran DOS and booted faster than this?
I remember 1-2 megahertz CPM machines booted faster.
I remember overhead slides like the ones you print in your printer.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you are old.
And, well, how about film strip projectors? Those are even better. See, now I'm showing my age. Where's my file? Okay, now we'll get started. Sound, the audio part, is just as much of the part of the environment or all these rooms as the heat and the lights, we think, although not all architects seem to agree with that. As I mentioned, we're going to talk about the first three things here and principally about the first one. But first we need to do a few basics. And I always put this slide in, a little disclaimer. This topic is very wide and broad. We can't possibly do justice to it in a couple hours tonight. Don't use this presentation to try to design your room. The intent is not to do that. When we get through here, you're not going to be able to design your studio or your church, but hopefully you will know what some of the issues are and maybe be able to communicate with your acoustical consultant a little better. Or maybe if you have a facility of your own, you'll be able to identify what a problem is and know who to call to fix it. There's four pieces to a sound wave, and in this context, it doesn't really matter if we're talking about an electrical signal or an acoustical one. And this is just a picture of a sine wave. Everybody's familiar with it. We have wavelength, which is from there to there. We have period, which is the inverse of that. We have amplitude, which is from here to here. And we have frequency, which is the period divided by time. The human ear is a fairly remarkable gizmo as a transducer, and I think it's important to think about this when we talk about acoustics, because the ear has a greater dynamic range than anything else on your head. 130 decibels, more or less, depending on how you define that. 130 dB is 10 million to one in terms of energy. That's a pretty wide range of levels to deal with. If your bathroom scale could deal with that, it could weigh everything from a building to a human hair. So that's part of our problem here, is that the ear has this huge dynamic range. Some of this is stuff everybody already knows, but I want to bring a couple of things to your attention. One is that we talk about all these systems and stuff that goes up to 18 or 20,000 hertz. Well, at least for the fundamentals, nothing's up there. In fact, half of us in this room, certainly myself included, can't hear anything up there anyway. Our ears are shot. If you're 19 years old and if you don't own an iPod, maybe. Most of the kids now can't hear that high anymore, at least the ones I've tested. What does some spectra look like? What do you suppose that is? Something a little bit heavy on the bass, but pretty broad. Anybody want to guess? That's a washing machine at a meter. Something in the 60s, low 60s, high 50s. What do you suppose that is?
Ambient.
That's a typical ambient level of a room. I don't know what, that's a fairly quiet room, a little bit quieter than this one, at least where I'm standing.
Vacuum cleaner.
Good guess. Vacuum cleaners are actually pretty noisy if you've ever put a sound level meter or your analyzer to them.
Truck.
Good guess. Now, trucks vary a lot. But that's a pretty typical truck. I've seen trucks noisier than that.
Threshold of hearing.
Yeah. The important thing to remember here is that everybody says, oh, the threshold of hearing is zero by definition. Well, that's true for those 18-year-old ears and for the average 18-year-old person who does not own an iPod. But the key is that when that's for mid-band stuff, speech, in other words. At low frequencies, especially the very low frequencies, the threshold is actually quite a bit higher, 30 dB higher roughly at 60 hertz and even higher than that at 20 hertz.
So what's that curve look like for somebody our age? Somebody our age.
Can yeah.
How high
what?
What?
I don't know that I could generalize, and I'm not an expert on that anyway. There is a good book on that topic if anybody's interested in seeing the statistics, although I'm not sure how valid it is today because it was written about 25, 30 years ago. And the name of that book is The Effects of Noise on Man by Carl Kreider, one of my favorite texts on hearing and environmental noise, community noise. A little dated, but an excellent text. Some people experience a significant high-frequency loss. That's probably the most common, so this would creep up in some cases dramatically. Somebody, my dad is probably up here. He's deaf as a post. Actually, I think a post can hear better than he can.
Per year.
Well, that thing is a typical voice spectrum. Now, my voice probably, this lovely melodious thing is probably down here someplace. My wife says I sound like a gravel truck driving over washboards. But the point is that our speech is... Most of the energy is at around 500 hertz. This also doesn't show the differences between men and women, which are also significant. And there's a wide variation, but just between individuals. But most of our energy is in the 500 hertz region, as you see here. But something to keep in mind is that, at least for Western languages, the intelligibility of speech is up here in this part. It's the difference between P and T, for instance. And that's where the intelligibility is. Now, that becomes important if part of our acoustical problem is to prevent people from listening to our conversations on the other side of the wall. Oh, no. This is getting old. Well, folks, we're crashed again.
We could try and load it on that other machine.
Yeah, I have a thumb drive in my pocket, actually. We think maybe we should do that.
Want to try that?
Yes, but I first need to get this thing rebooted so we can get the file. Actually, I think a slightly older version of the file is already on here. Okay. Let's do that. I think we're okay. We need to actually ask. Okay. Is this USB right here? Yeah.
This over here?
Yes. Yeah, over here. it'll run fast if it's on the desktop. Okay. There is, yeah, although I can do it. He's got it in. I can do without it if we need to.
Craig, I want to talk to you about that.
Is it function in F4? Is that how you did it before? I transferred it from the That was the one he was using before. There you go.
Okay.
Now we gotta get up on here so you have to get one more press to do that.
Now we lost it up there.
Usually it's one, the other, and then both.
This is a different version. How do I start the show?
Should be able to go into...
Isn't it slideshow?
Slideshow.
Setup? No.
Yeah, they changed everything.
Oh, view.
View.
I bet.
View show.
Right, find the button.
Slideshow?
There it is. There it is. There we go. Okay.
So we're in the process of signing in the
Yeah, we did. Well, if we can't get it on both, then I can guess. Yeah, that'll work. Okay. All right, we're back now.
Settle down, children.
We're scaling, so some of these are going to look like the devil, but this is the so-called Fletcher-Munson curves of equal loudness, which simply illustrates that the frequency response of our hearing mechanism is not linear and varies not only with frequency, but also with level. Tends to flatten out at high levels, but at really low levels, you lose bass. That appears to be an adaptation so that the intelligibility of speech is maximized when the speech is not that loud. There's a number of variations of other people who have repeated this and come up with slightly different curves, but the old ones that Fletcher originally did have held up pretty well here. In the mid-band, right about here is where we typically talk. If I'm from here to there, the levels can vary with the talk or the distance and the circumstances. And at really low levels, you can see that there's a very definite emphasis of the mid and upper mid frequencies. People like JJ can talk about that curve for, I don't know, a couple weeks probably, and still not fully explain it. This is an outcome of this. We need to know about this, which is to be able to measure things. There's a filter called a weighting filter that's often applied to measurements, both electrical and acoustical. This is very abused, the concept of a weighting, and I constantly see people walk in with their sound level meter at a rock concert that's blasting away at 118 or whatever it is, and they have their meter set to A-weighting. Now, if they're trying to make the number as low as possible, that might make sense if the guy from the police is there. But in terms of, if you remember those curves, when it's loud, your ear is pretty flat. So for really loud stuff, you should be using flat weighting if you're trying to approximate correlate your measurement with how loud it sounds to a human being. On the other hand, if it's at about 60 or 70 dB, then this is an appropriate curve. There are also other curves. There's a B curve and a C weighting curve. C is almost flat, but not quite, and B is kind of in between. There's probably some others I don't know about.
The reason you walk around with your meter at A at a concert is because the laws are written in A, and you're correlating your reading to the law rather than to the...
That can be true, and that's a whole other subject as well. We could talk about that, Adam and I, and maybe Lindsay could help talk about that for another couple of weeks. And but the point you're making, which is entirely valid, is that most of the laws about noise and intrusion and that sort of thing are very poorly written. A fair amount of our work concerns working for somebody, either the offender or the offended, in connection with those laws. So depending on which side we're on, we'll either defend the law or tear it to pieces.
Great answer.
You've probably all seen charts like this before. Here's conversation, something in the 60, maybe 65 dB range. A jet plane at 100 feet, I don't know who actually measured that. I've never been 100 feet from a jet plane, at least on the outside, before. Rock concert, 120, way too loud, but a lot of them actually do that. I once did the sound at a tractor pull, and I was about 150 feet from one of these tractors that happened to be powered by two jet engines, and I had my Ivy there, and I had on a set of David Clark hearing defenders, and I was still uncomfortable, and the Ivy was saying, A-weighted, mind you, 128. It was all mid-band stuff. And the guy who was driving it didn't even have any plugs in his ears. Anyway, that's some typical levels.
Two trips that you don't need.
How many people were at the talk we gave about decibels a couple of years ago? Okay. Well, some of this is a little bit of a review, but a couple of things are important. If you double the amount of energy, that's a 3.01 something something increase. You might think intuitively that would be twice as loud. It's not. Most people will say roughly 10 dB is twice as loud, although that depends on the level, the type of sound it is, what the ambient noise level is, and it's also subjective. To me, 10 dB is more than twice as loud. To others, maybe it's a little less. 3 dB, we often say, is a barely audible change. Those of you who work in a studio will say, rubbish, it's a big change. Well, maybe, but if I change something 3 dB and you come back tomorrow, you won't notice it. And that's important when we're dealing with acoustics, because if you want to improve the transmission loss of that wall or that leaky window or that door, you need a lot more than a 50% reduction in energy. You need more than 90% usually. Now, if this works, this mouse hooked up. That's 10 dB less. That's a 90% reduction in the amount of energy, 90%. So when your carpenter says he's going to remove 90% of the energy with this soundproof wall, that's how much you get. Maybe that's enough. Usually it's not. That's 20%. That's a 99% reduction in energy.
Could you go from the 10 dB to the peak noise to hear that difference?
From here and go up?
Yeah.
Okay.
See, that sounds three times as loud to me.
Yeah. See? We at the decibel thing, we did a show of hands to see who thought what was twice as loud or half as loud. There was no two people agreed. It's worse for audio types, I think. The populace is a little more closely clustered. here's a 3 dB change. Now, to me, that's not terribly significant. I wouldn't call it barely audible, but it is barely audible over a long period of time. We're doing something where there's an instantaneous change. But if I played that now and you went to the restroom and came back and I played it 3 dB different, I doubt if you would notice if I didn't tell you. And that's what we mean by a barely noticeable change. Where are we? When we talk about this stuff, we aren't only going to talk about sound through air. Sound is what we usually think we detect with our ears, which is vibration transmitted through the air, which is an inelastic compressible medium of gaseous molecules. But sound also goes through solid stuff. In fact, it goes through solid stuff a lot better than it does through air. And when it gets there, it may turn back into airborne sound. And that's very important if we're talking about transmission loss or vibration isolation. I once did a project where we were measuring sound in a hotel where on the second floor of the hotel, I could hear the carts being pushed around in the restaurant, which was on the seventh floor. And it was loud enough to wake me up. And I have been known to sleep through earthquakes and fire alarms. But this was a very nasty sound, and that was a structure-borne problem that went right down the steel and concrete columns and was being radiated in my room as sound by the jetboard that had been applied directly to those columns. That was a vibration isolation problem. Sound propagates more or less spherically from a point source, and we all talk about the inverse square law. Sound intensity of sound will decrease 6 dB for each doubling of distance. This is also much abused. It's only for a point source in free space. Even my mouth is not truly a point source. It's bigger than a point. And this is not free space. So the direct sound is or the sound that you're hearing is not really doing that. But for some things, for outdoors, and if you're a long ways away compared to the dimensions of the radiator, it's a fairly close approximation. Unless it's a line source. What if it's a highway or a railroad? Those things, the dimension of the sound generating thing, whether it's I-5 or a train, they tend to be line sources, which means that they're not radiating from a point, they're radiating from a line. Think of the wavefront emanating as a cylinder rather than a sphere. Those only go down 3 dB for doubling. It's important to understand the propagation of sound. And a lot of you know this, but maybe haven't really thought about it and don't know the terminology very well. When sound, if I stand here and shout at this, this is a fairly hard surface. Most of the energy of my voice is reflected off it, the same as my light. You know, I can't get a very good reflection there, but off the window. Anybody see that? Anyway, a lot of that light is being reflected, and a lot of my voice energy is also being reflected by that hard surface. And we think of it as reflecting like a light ray. It really doesn't do that. The actual physics are kind of complicated, and I won't have time to go into it. But it tends to behave as if it were a ray, so it's valid to think of it as a ray that reflects like light off a mirror, even though it doesn't actually do that work quite that way physically. That's called reflection. But there's another phenomenon called diffraction. Well, light will diffract too. And I'm not a physicist, so I don't understand that well enough to explain it. But sound essentially does the same thing. And we talk about this as if the sound rays bend around the edge of the barrier. They don't really bend, at least if there's no temperature or pressure gradient. But the effect is the same, and the reason is that we have this three-dimensional sea of billiard balls called air molecules, and they're all bouncing around, and the ones that are going this way and this way and this way and this way, well, all of them going this way or more are blocked, but the ones that are here are not blocked, and so even though the average of all of this motion is in this direction, when we block it, these are blocked, but these are not. So some energy behaves as if it goes around the corner. And that's also important to know if you're worried about isolation. And anybody who's ever set up a barrier in a recording studio knows that they don't work all that well, even if you're outdoors at some frequencies. If the air has any gradient of temperature or pressure, refraction will occur. The air actually behaves like a lens. And it will bend the propagation of sound, this sort of a wave thing, in one direction or the other. You've probably all been out on a lake in a fishing boat or something on a really quiet Saturday morning, and you hear somebody talking, and you realize the guy's 4 miles away in another boat. Well, how can that be? And that's because there's an inversion early in the morning from the water surface into the air in the first few feet of air. And so the propagation of sound keeps getting bent down and down and down. So it isn't dissipating at 6 dB, it's dissipating at a much lower value. Anybody who's done sound outdoors on a really hot afternoon knows that sometimes this stuff disappears, and sometimes that's an inversion in the other direction when you aim the speaker this way, but it's going that way. And at, I think it was Indianapolis, used to actually have two sets of loudspeakers at the Motor Speedway. And one set looked like it was aimed at the ground, but that's what they used at certain times of the day to compensate for that problem. When sound hits a barrier, that wall over there, for instance, what happens to it? Well, some of it is absorbed, some of it is reflected, and some of it is transmitted, or leaks through, if you will. That's what we usually say. It doesn't really leak through unless the barrier is actually porous, in which case some of it might. But what happens is when I go over and talk at that wall, the wall moves in response to the acoustical energy of my voice. And as the surface of the wall here moves, it moves the studs a little bit, and there's another piece of jibboard on the other side of that, and they move in sympathy like this. And some of the energy of my voice is re-radiated by the wall on the other side. That's called transmission. Okay, now we're going to actually talk about what we came to talk about. If we have sound, whether it's the sound of my voice or a sound of a loudspeaker, which is what most of us are interested in, we all know what those things look like. They give us pretty pictures and whatnot, but then you read down at the bottom where they did that in an anechoic chamber. Unless you're going to use it in free space, it isn't going to sound like that. In fact, it won't even sound like that outdoors unless you're a couple hundred feet above ground and you're not more than, we'll say, 50 feet from the loudspeaker. Once you enclose that sound in a space, an enclosure, then we have all these things going on, and the character of the sound changes completely. The timbre of the loudspeaker will appear to be different. The distribution of sound will be different. A whole bunch of things happening. Now, the quality of that sound, you can sort of tune it like you might tune with an equalizer by fiddling with the size, the shape, and the finishes inside that space. And that's what we're going to talk about. I'm not going to get into any theory today, not that that isn't interesting, but we don't have time for that. A lot of you probably already read a little bit of that anyway. If you haven't, I can direct you to some good books. But what we are going to talk about is pretty nuts and boltsy thing. So what does somebody mean when they say the acoustics are bad? Well, it could mean a whole bunch of different things. And that's the first question you have to ask. If somebody says, well, this room is crappy, the acoustics are no good, what does that mean? Might mean two different, totally different things depending on what their criteria is. Is it too noisy? Is it too echoey? You've all heard that. Is it too dead? That can be a problem in some rooms. We were talking about that at dinner. Can you not understand what's being said? That's a separate problem from I can't hear it, or might be. Sometimes you can't understand it because it's not loud enough, but more often you can't understand it because the direct reverberant ratio is bad. Or maybe I can hear too well. I'm in an office and I don't want to hear Joe Blow on the telephone all day. Or sometimes the sound system is crappy and you blame it on the room. We've never done that, have we? There's some things to think about, and we could talk a couple of weeks just on this slide alone. In a big room, the Kingdom, for instance, analysis of acoustical properties tend to be largely statistical, time-based, because the propagation time in any one direction is so long that that the decay of sound, even at the low frequencies, tends to be a statistical problem. So we talk about things like reverberation time. In a really small room, say the cavities of your headphones, that's a really small room, it really isn't a room at all, it's a cavity. The wavelength of even the fairly high frequency sounds is larger, or at least the middle frequency sounds is larger than any dimension of that cavity, and so it's like a cavity you would have in RF work if anybody's done waveguides and things like that. The pressure at any given instant is the same every place. There are no reflections because the room is too small. Now the problem is that most of the rooms we work in are kind of in the middle, so at some frequencies they behave, at really low frequencies they might behave like a cavity, at middle frequencies they become a geometric problem, and at the high frequencies they become a statistical problem. So in real rooms, rooms this size or a studio or a control room, you have to think about all three. Most people know what reverberation time is. It's defined as the time it takes for the sound once it's been cut off. As you start with a steady state sound within a room, you cut it off instantly. The time it takes to decay 60 decibels is defined as the reverberation time. It varies with frequency. It's proportional to volume, inversely proportional to the amount of absorption in the room and the amount of surface area in the room. Actually, the sum of the surface areas times the absorption is a thing called Sabins. And then, depending on whether you're working in the metric of the English system, there's some correction factors to make it come out in seconds.
Is this what you mean by a statistical problem?
Yes. This is statistical analysis. On this slide, the intent here is to let you hear a hand clap in an empty room and then the same hand clap in the same empty room that's had a bunch of carpet put around and has become deader. And it would work fine if I could get the slide to work. The problem is that the WAV files that go with these buttons are on my file server. I even tested this before I came over here, and it worked fine. And the reason was because I didn't realize that the laptop had been wirelessly connected to the file server, so it found them just fine. But when I got here, it didn't find them, and now we're on a different computer anyway. So I will be putting, I hope, this slide pack up on our website. And when I do, I'll figure out a way to get these files on there so you can hear that. But you've probably all heard rooms that were just so reverberant that you can't understand speech unless I'm really close like this. And if I were talking to the fellas in the back, they wouldn't have any clue what I was saying, although they might hear me perfectly well. They can't understand speech. And this one's important. You probably run into this thing called noise reduction coefficient. If you buy a piece of, a piece of acoustical tile maybe, or a chunk of wall panel, this has an NRC of 0.5 to 0.95. And you say, okay, well, I want to reduce the noise that's going out into the hall, so I must need a bunch of this stuff, so I'll buy some of this and put it on the wall. You just wasted your money. Doesn't have anything to do with reducing noise out in the hall. What the noise reduction coefficient is the average absorption coefficient, which is the percentage of energy, more or less, that's being absorbed versus reflected. In other words, I have a certain amount of energy impinging on this surface. The percentage that is reflected is the inverse of the noise reduction coefficient. The trouble is that most fuzzy absorptive materials don't have a very high transmission loss. If this didn't have a piece of plastic on it, I could talk through it and you wouldn't actually notice very much difference. Another gotcha is that the NRC is an average of the measured coefficients at 250, 500, 1,000, 2,000 reported to the nearest 5% or 0.05. It's important to recognize that they don't measure the performance at low frequencies. For this panel right here, which is pretty good, 0.9 is pretty good, at 20 hertz it's probably 5%, if that. Why? It's not thick enough. But that doesn't count. Well, why would they do that? Well, for most purposes, we're dealing with speech, and that's designed to work at speech frequencies. The trouble is most of you guys, myself included, aren't always dealing with speech. You might be dealing with music. NRC doesn't tell the whole story for what happens with music, especially if your music has a lot of bass in it.
How are these coefficients measured? If you have a piece of material, how do you come up with that NRC number?
There's a procedure that's codified by standard and ASTM. Adam, help me out. ASTM. ASTM something, some three or four digit number. Basically, you use a reverberation chamber that is calibrated. You take your sample of a certain size and you measure the sound before and after, and then you do some calculations.
Okay, so it's a calculated value.
It is a measured and then calculated value, okay. Yes. It's important. That brings up an interesting point, because sometimes you will see fancier constructions than this, especially big thick ones that are designed to be pretty good at low frequencies, and you'll see it has an NRC of 1.05.
Whoa.
Well, how can that happen? How can anything be 105% absorptive? And the reason is that the calculation only takes into account the surface area, the frontal surface area of the product. But some products have significant amount of absorption on the sides. So that's kind of a freebie, and at some frequencies, that freebie is enough to make it appear to be more than perfectly absorptive.
Because it's so thick.
Yes. It really isn't, and in fact, you won't get that if you buy a bunch of them and butt them up against each other, because then you don't have that anymore. This just illustrates that sound isn't just what goes from me to you. It's bouncing hundreds, thousands of times off every surface in this room before it eventually dies out and quits hitting your ears. And what you hear is the sum of all of that, not just the direct sound. And most people know that rooms with a lot of highly reflective surfaces as opposed to absorptive ones are very live, and speech will sound terrible in that room. Some kinds of music might sound good if you have a church with a pipe organ in it. That's actually your goal, is to make it as long a reverb time as you can, especially at the low frequencies. Speech, you'd want a much data room, you want a fair amount of absorption. You can make them too dead in some cases, but usually not. And in between other kinds of music, all have a certain ideal characteristic. The point is, what's good for music is not good for speech and vice versa in most cases. You've probably seen a chart like this around. There's many variations of this. It shows reverberation time on the x-axis, and then different kinds of spaces shown stacked up here, with the shaded area being the ideal reverberation time, and the dashed areas being acceptable reverberation time. And you'll, and it's awfully hard to read. I apologize for that. We will put the slides up. But recording studios and things like that usually want to be pretty dead. The cathedral with the pipe organ wants to be pretty live. Liturgical stuff with organ wants to be pretty live. Rock bands somewhere in the middle. Cinema, there's your home theater. Actually, in my mind, a home theater should be a little deader than a commercial cinema house. But they're pretty dead. For a big room, you want to be around a second quarter maybe. Why? It's mostly a speech room. If you can't hear the dialogue, you can't get the movie.
Also, surround sound is already supplying reverberation for
yes.
you, so you don't need to add...
Artificial reverberation is always mixed into it, even if it isn't surround, but that's also a good point. But the real purpose of the room is to make sure that the dialogue is intelligible. There's all kinds of absorbing stuff around. This is one. I've got some of these. We can pass them around if you like. How many people have used Sonex? Well, not too many. How many people have used packing foam? You do know by now, I hope, that it's not fire rated. Unfortunately, some of the commercial products aren't either. You have to be careful. In fact, Sonex itself made some at one time that wasn't. They don't anymore. In fact, I don't know of any commercial company that is, yeah.
You should probably go ahead and tell the whole story about packing foam just so people know, just in case they don't
see. Okay, I can do that briefly. For those who don't know, there was a fire in Rhode Island that killed a whole bunch of people because there was a nightclub that had been treated with packing foam that looks kind of like that, only with bumps instead of sharp wedges. And to the uninitiated eye, looks the same as some models of Sonex, but it was packing foam. The problem with packing foam is it's not fire treated, and when you burn it, it's made of foamed polyvinyl chloride. When you burn polyvinyl chloride, what do you get? Chlorine. Chlorine is nasty stuff. One whiff and you're dead. It's just about that bad. In addition, it burns very well. One rep has likened it to solid gasoline. They make wire made with PVC on the outside, but that's why in commercial buildings, one of the reasons that wire is put in conduit. So you don't want to use unfire-rated stuff on the walls. It's dangerous, and it will void your insurance. There's
people died in that fire.
Yes, so. And many more were injured. Anybody ever run into Tectum? Mm-hmm. Looks like molded Excelsior, what we used to pack stuff in. That's Tectum was originally developed as an inexpensive roof deck, and then somebody noticed that did wonders for the acoustics. The problem with Tectum is it's kind of variable acoustically. You can make an absorbing wall panel out of perforated metal. This is a chunk of perforated metal with plain old fiberglass inside it. You can do perforated wood of all kinds. Some of these are quite nifty looking, and the perforations are kind of hard to see. This one, for instance, take a close look at it. It is perforated. That's actually a fairly decent panel, other than the price.
Yeah.
This one's cheaper, not as good. Sonex is a manufacturer, well-known manufacturer of commercial foams that are textured to improve their appearance as well as their absorbing characters. The deeper they are, the lower the frequency at which they maintain their absorbing values. You can have perforations. There's a little bit of science in deciding how many holes you need, how big they are, and what the spacing is. Ideally, the perforations wouldn't all be the same size or evenly spaced, but just try to sell the architect on that. Oops, skipped one. The other thing that can happen with a surface is it can be diffusive. This is different than a straight reflection. This means that the energy is not being absorbed, it's being returned back into the room, but not as a specular reflection. Think of it this way. If I had a piece of tin foil and I held it out and looked at it, I can actually use it for a mirror. That's a specular reflection, whether it's light or audio. But take the piece of tin foil and I wad it up, and then I smooth it back out again, it no longer works very well as a mirror. The image is almost indistinguishable because the light is being reflected every which way because it's no longer flat. Sound does the same thing. This is called diffusion. Diffusion is usually far better than a specular reflection in audio. There are times when you don't want diffusion, you do want a specular reflection, but not very often. In geometric terms, this illustrates sound impinging on the surface and then being scattered in every direction. That would be ideal diffusion if it's scattered in every direction equally. They don't work quite that well, although this one does. You may recognize this as a diagram of a quadratic diffuser made by RPG, who makes very good diffusing panels that also cost a lot of money. This is what that diffusive effect looks like in time. You could think of diffusion as anti-glare coating for acoustics. This just illustrates the RPG style. I think they still have a patent on this. Has that run out yet? Does anybody remember? I don't think so.
But it's close.
It is probably close. This is an RPG panel in a real studio. This particular panel is made of wood. Most of them are. We also have resonant absorbers, which are Helmholtz resonators and variations thereof. You may have seen anybody's high school gym have this stuff in it. It was cinder block that had little slots in it. Remember that? We actually don't like this stuff very well because this is what the absorbing characteristics look like, and which is fine if the only thing you're trying to absorb is at 150 hertz. But they're not very broad band. They try to make them broader by using different size slots and doing some other games. In theory, though, you could make really good absorption by having a sufficient number of Helmholtz resonators of sufficiently different sizes and locations. You could actually do this. They have discovered that some of the old Roman arenas actually use this. For years they didn't really know what those funny holes were for, and then they discovered that they're all different, and they were actually understood this science maybe better than we do, or at least used it better than we do. I think some of the Greeks were doing that too, weren't they? Does anybody know for sure? I'm not sure. One type of resonant absorber, the ubiquitous bass trap. How many people have seen those advertised in your favorite home theater magazine? It's basically just a Helmholtz resonator designed to soak up low frequencies. Well, the problem with bass traps is, in practice, they really don't work very well for the things people are trying to apply them to. Most people are trying to fix bass problems that are below 100 hertz. And this type of absorber needs to be at least a quarter wavelength deep to work. Say you want to soak up 20 hertz. What's the wavelength of 20 hertz? 55, I think it's closer to 52, but close enough for government work. So what's a quarter wavelength? 12, 13 feet. Pretty hard to ship that. They don't actually sell any that made that way, I don't know. I have seen bass traps that deep built into the architecture of rooms, but it's not usually an off-the-shelf product. This is a plan view looking down. So here's the wall all along here, and we have
a train going
on. Train. That boy is something. What did I drink for dinner?
Not a stroke, don't worry.
What we're depicting here is a porous surface might be made of compressed fiberglass, for example, that lets sound come in here, and then we have all this fuzz inside. This is one way to make the interior highly absorbent. But basically, we have a cavity, and we create absorption at a certain frequency by virtue of the dimensions of that cavity.
How tall is that?
This way?
No. Z. Perpendicular to the screen. How deep is it?
Usually they would be square, but not always. It depends on how they're trying to do it.
So it's cubic?
No, not necessarily. It depends. Let me go back to another slide here. It depends on what shape of the curve you're trying to get. If you're trying to absorb a very specific frequency, and you might have a reason for doing that. You might be building a studio next to train tracks aren't very tonal, but next to some kind of a machine that puts out a whine or a whistle or a low frequency tone that's tonal, not very broad band, one specific tone. You look at it on your analyzer and you see one spike sticking up, it's at one frequency. Then Helmholtz resonators might help you and you might deliberately design them to be narrow.
Would you ever use one on a cubic room that had a really nasty standing waves?
Well, you might, but the problem is usually those really nasty standing waves are at low frequencies, so you got to make these things really big. But in theory, yes, that's a good way to use them.
Eigentones, I guess.
I'm going to sprinkle a couple more slides in like this, and somebody asked me at dinner about snake oil. Even the good products, some of the things I'm passing around, beware of the data. Be especially aware of anything the salesman says. But even beware of things that the manufacturer puts in writing on their data sheet. They're often misleading, usually exaggerated, and sometimes just plain fraudulent, in my opinion. And my opinion isn't always shared by that particular manufacturer. But what you should do is deal with manufacturers you know are reliable and know how to fudge their data in your mind. It's the same as loudspeakers. We all know that loudspeaker specs are largely bogus, but we've all become accustomed to reading them appropriately because we know that particular manufacturer and we know how they made their measurements and we know which way they fudge and by how much. And you know that that Soundelier background music speaker is not really better than that big Altec Lansing cabinet, even though the numbers say it is, because you just know that. Same thing here. When you're evaluating an acoustical product, one of the things that we do when we're looking at something we've not seen before or haven't measured personally is we want to see data from an independent laboratory. And there's laboratories around the country, Riverbank and the like, that do this kind of work for a living. And if you can get a copy of their report that says they tested that brand and that model of acoustical panel and they got this result, you can pretty well bank on that. You can usually accept independent laboratory data on the cut sheet, but it is possible, of course, that they cheated and didn't actually have that test done, or the data they're quoting is from a different product, or was from a product they submitted for testing 14 years ago and they don't make them in the same factory anymore, or something like that. But the point is, there's a lot of snake oil out there, including snake oil data from products that actually are pretty good and applicable, but you can't rely on the numbers they're giving you. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the shape of the room. These reflections that we're talking about, if it's a flat surface, it's pretty well reflected. Angle of incidence equals angle of reflection and all that sort of thing, and nothing happens. But if it's a curved surface, concave or convex, then different things happen. If it's concave, it will actually focus, just like a concave mirror or the satellite dish on your roof. Now, that's a problem unless you're trying to create a really good hot spot someplace. Then you might want to do that. How many people have gone to Temple Square in Salt Lake City to the Mormon Tabernacle and listened to the famous pin drop? Oh, a couple people. Well, what they do, that room is an ellipse. The roof is a giant ellipsoid. And what they do is they herd all of the victims over to this place as close as possible to one of the focal points of the ellipsoid, and then they have a table at the other focal point of the ellipsoid, and they drop a pin on that table, and you're, I don't know what, a couple hundred feet away? Can't remember how big that room is. Quite a ways. And you hear this clunk from this pin drop way up there. And everybody goes, ooh. And they used to describe this room as having perfect acoustics. Well, I know the sound people in the Mormon church, and they've had nothing but grief with that room ever since Brigham Young built it, because it focuses between two points, and that's not desirable unless the talker's at one point and the listener's at the other. Well, the trouble is the talker isn't always in one of those focal points, and none of the listeners are, except maybe about 10 or 20 people.
Mark, I was on the phone Sunday with Steve Barber, who did the installation at the big new conference center there.
Yes.
in Tabernacle Square. Now, that room is the room that the Mormon Tabernacle Church had to use for the last, I don't know, a couple of years or whatever, when they were redoing the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the Tabernacle.
Yeah.
Well, when they were over at the new facility, and by the way, that's a huge room that seats 21,500 and a cast of performers up to about 800.
No columns. 21 no seats, columns. 21,000 people, unsupported roof, no columns.
A remarkably good, not only visually wonderful view, but acoustically, it's an incredible achievement. Anyway, so the choir went over to the new place in the meanwhile, and they liked that better than the Tabernacle. So, anyway.
Yeah.
So much for...
Focusing is usually not good. If you have a concave surface, it's going to tend to focus. If you have a convex surface, it will tend to scatter the reflection. That might be valuable. And if it's flat, it just tends to reflect. Angle of incidence equals angle of reflection. Something between here and here is often useful if you're trying to steer those reflections where you want them, which is ideally anything reflected off the ceiling ought to be evenly distributed between here and here. So the challenge is to find a shape and a placement that does that, and that's why you see all these crazy, I thought I had another slide there. That's why you see all these crazy shapes of ceilings with curved or flat reflectors set at all funny angles. That's what they're trying to do, is to evenly distribute that first reflection into the seating area and keep all those reflections off the back wall and other surfaces where there are no one is sitting. We could talk about this stuff for a couple of weeks too. What we're looking at here is time across the x-axis and intensity here. Now, this is an illustration of what would happen if we put a pulse, a spike of noise or something into a room, and then we go out someplace in the space with our measuring microphone and we record what happens. Those of you who have used TAF or other FFT analysis will find this familiar. So what you get first, if the sound occurs here, then the first thing you see is the direct sound. And the delay there is just propagation time between the sound and wherever you are. It takes roughly a millisecond per foot to get there. So you have a certain amount of delay there. Then you'll get the first reflection, which is usually off the ceiling or the floor. More frequently the floor, but depends. In this room it might be off the ceiling. Even for those of us who are longitudinally challenged, I think I'm closer to the ceiling than the floor. So you get the first reflection there. The difference in time between the direct sound and that first reflection is called the initial time delay gap. That's a very important thing to know for a given room, because if you get in a big room and this initial time delay gap gets very long, you have all kinds of problems. If the initial time delay gap is short, say 30 milliseconds or less, then your hearing mechanism will tend to integrate this early sound into the direct sound, and it's actually useful. But if the time delay gap is too long, say 100 milliseconds or more, say you're in the kingdom, then that's heard as a discrete echo and will obliterate intelligibility as well as drive you crazy. So this is something you need to look at. And the more, ideally what we want is lots and lots of reflections so jammed together that we just have a continuous splatter of sound here with the initial time delay gap not too long. At some point, this slide is marked 80 milliseconds, but that number is certainly debatable. I don't even agree with myself about that. And I doubt if anyone else at Greenbush does either. But at some point, you draw a line and say, well, the stuff that got there before this is early reflections and the other stuff is late reflections. The late reflections are considered noise. That's the reverberation tail that you hear in live rooms. The early reflections, for the most part, if they're nicely clustered and you don't have a focused one that's sticking up above the direct sound, are generally useful. And yes, a reflection can be more intense than the direct sound. How can that be, you say, when we have inverse square law? Focusing.
When you have interference of two reflections.
Say again?
When you have a positive interference of two reflections.
Yes, that too. We had got some data just the other day on a room that had a focusing problem between a curved rear wall in a council chambers made of glass and a curved dais up in the front, and there the focus point of both of those was where the lectern was located. How do you think that sounded? And how much gain before feedback do you think they got? Not good and not very much was the answer. And in that case, Bruce Main, I don't know if anybody knows him, he's a rep here in town, had made the measurements with using TEF. The first, that reflection, the first bounce, a compound bounce off those curved surfaces was about 10 dB hotter than the direct sound.
Oops.
As measured in the in his audience seating location. So that's a problem.
So you want to spray insulation on the glass then? Is that?
We're still talking to the owner about that. One of the problems is that they're very, very proud of the architecture of the space, and and this space is LEED Platinum certified, which means that the certification for LEED depends upon that glass being transparent to light to light that space naturally from the exterior windows that are across the hall from that glass. So it's not going to be an easy problem to solve.
Transparent aluminum, I think.
Absorptive aluminum. Actually, if someone can develop an absorptive glass, we would be very appreciative. It would be a handy product.
There is a perforated translucent plastic that up against.
Yes, and actually we were thinking about, this is Adam who works in our office and actually knows more about acoustics in some ways than I do. I probably should have him give this talk, actually. I didn't know you were coming. I should have you come up and finish this. No, I'll fiddle with the computer.
I'm learning.
There have been some experiments to do that using perforated sandwiches of stuff with airspace in them that look pretty promising. But so far, we haven't had a practical way to make a window that's absorptive, but that's very much needed.
Is it transparent or translucent?
I believe it can be either, although not totally transparent. I haven't seen it. Have you seen it?
Yeah, both.
Is it fairly transparent? It has little holes in it, so it can't be water clear. But so you could actually discern an image through it?
Right, depending upon the distortion from the perforations. But the material itself is fairly transparent.
Yeah. Who makes that? Do you remember?
I don't remember. Off the top of my head, I think it might be RPG or Decoustics. I don't remember.
Mm.
One of the big.
Well, if it's RPG, it'll be expensive. But good. I don't mean to disparage RPG. In fact, they have an excellent website. It's rpginc.com. You should all go there because there's a lot of white papers and just general good information there about acoustics. And they are one of the companies whose data you can rely on. They are not budget products for the most part. But they do have some interesting things that aren't too expensive. One of them is this little panel, which looks really silly when you first look at it, and then you realize what they've done, and it's extremely clever. I suppose they probably have a patent on this. It looks like plain old fiberglass, compressed fiberglass panel, Owens Corning, I don't know, 701 or something, I suppose, with acoustically transparent fabric over it. That's pretty conventional. Everybody and their brother makes that. But there's this septum inside, some kind of a phenolic thing that has these holes poked in it. And the holes look like they're kind of done randomly, but they're not. This is sort of a quadratic diffuser approach mathematically. And what this panel does is it's absorptive below 1,000 hertz or so, and above 1,000 hertz or so, it's a diffuser. It's called BED, which stands for Binary Absorptive Diffsorber or something like that, BAD. Kind of a poor man's RPG panel, but should work pretty well. I've not heard of room that had these in them, but I trust this company.
Who makes that?
RPG. I'll pass that around. I need this back, though. In fact, I need all the samples back. This just shows a side view of a typical auditorium where we have this shaped ceiling that's trying to distribute the reflections from the stage across the seating area. and we have direct sound going to the seating area, and we have sound coming off the stage enclosure going into the seating area. And if all the shaping and stuff is done properly, you get a nice hall like Ben Arroyo. And if it isn't, you get some of the other rooms that all of us have worked in. One of the problems is that this shaping is sometimes difficult to convince the architect or even the owner that the shape really does need to be that way, because they want to select the shape of the room for appearance and sometimes for sight lines, and those may conflict with what's ideal acoustically. How many people know the difference between echo and reverberation?
Response?
Well, it's in actuality, there's kind of a certain amount of gray area between them. But in general, and reverberation is hundreds and thousands of reflections all clustered together that you just hear as this gradual decay of the sound that you cut off. Echo is a discrete reflection or cluster of reflections that you hear as if it was a single reflection or a delayed. A delayed duplicate of the original sound. And now, that's an echo. Might just be one single slapback, might be a whole series of them, might be some combination thereof. But that's as opposed, so you clap your hands and you hear this clang, 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 and that's echo. If you hear, you clap your hands and you just hear this gradual nice decay, but you can't identify discrete chunks for discrete arrivals, that's reverberation. In practice, real rooms tend to do both at the same time.
How would resonance factor into those two terms? It seems like reverberation would involve some resonance as well.
That's a hard question to answer. The answer is not no, but resonance is a phenomenon that we usually describe by geometric analysis, and reverberation time is temporal. In other words, it's a statistical analysis over time. But there are relationships, yes, as in real rooms. We're going to talk about room modes in a little bit. Maybe that'll clear it up a little bit. how long does the delay have to be for it to be considered an echo? Well, I don't agree with myself about this, but somewhere around 55, 60 milliseconds, sometimes as little as 40, sometimes maybe a little longer, depends on the relative level, the frequency, and a dozen other things.
Why is there a time point at all?
Remember the slide where if the initial time delay gap is short, the ear tends to integrate it in? Then it's not an echo. I can't hear it as a separate arrival.
But it's a house effect. If you had 150 millisecond delay,
that would definitely be an echo at 150 milliseconds.
The house effect for delaying loudspeakers, if they're in within a certain time.
So you mean the point at which an echo starts is about?
No, what I'm talking about is the time difference between the direct sound and and the copy or the duplicate.
So the time when it starts is about 60 and longer.
Any copy of the sound, of the direct sound that comes back to me delayed in time, if that delay is more than about 60 milliseconds, more or less, that will be perceived as an echo.
I remember when back at TAFCO tweaking reverb tanks, one of the springs was like 30 milliseconds delay, and then there was another one. You had to have two of them with a different delay.
Right.
I can't remember. 40 or 50.
Now, if that 60 millisecond echo is clustered on both sides with a whole bunch of other delays, you may not hear it, in which case it's not an echo. But if you hear a single duplicate, or the first duplicate is 60 milliseconds or so out, you'll definitely perceive that as an echo. I'm bothered by anything over 40 usually, but that's just me. It isn't always, the path that that echo takes isn't always simple, which is why you can really fool yourself here when you're looking at it either on paper or with an analyzer. Consider this room, a rectangular thing, and the one of the echo paths we have is this one, where the sound bounces off this big flat rear wall and comes back and hits the presenter in the face and the audience in the front part of the hall in the back of the head. That can be an echo. But let's say that that one is at 50 milliseconds and we have another one that we're hearing at 80 that could take this path, that could be bouncing off the wall, then off the back or off the ceiling, then off the back wall and coming back. That can be a little more difficult. And if you think about it, a real room has so many surfaces in so many different places that the number of possible paths, you can drive yourself to drink by even thinking about this. Anybody familiar with Chips Davis and his early LED studio work? Before he had good instrumentation, he would actually buy balls of string and use push pins and string and fill the room up with string, trying to illustrate where all of the first several reflections in every direction we're going. There's some interesting pictures in it was in Davis's Tech Topics, I think, of that. This problem might be solvable by doing some shaping like this in combination with some absorption on that back wall, and that would mitigate that echo problem. I don't have a watch. How are we doing on time?
9:15.
Okay.
Break? I think we should.
I have a spot for a break coming right up.
Okay.
All kinds of echo paths. You can get that one we talked about. You can treat that by putting absorption on the back wall. You can put diffusion on the back wall. You've all seen things like triangular shapes and cylindrical shapes and all that sort of thing. These, by the way, work well, but not as well as a real broadband diffuser like an RPG panel, because at really low frequencies, even that thing is still a reflector, because the dimensions of the shape is smaller than the wavelength at really low frequencies. But if you do it right and you manage to diffuse the midband, the middle of the speech frequencies, you'll probably be fairly happy. You can also do some shaping by splaying the surfaces to steer the reflections down, in this case, to the back rows where they might actually be useful if you get the delay times in the right place. Lateral reflections are extremely important, especially in a performance space. And almost all concert halls, you'll see some variation of this. There's a classic mini hall at UW is a classic for having strong lateral reflections, which I think are really important for subjective pleasure, listening pleasure, I guess. And that's done by creating these sidewall reflectors, and typically they're not only curved, but they're angled and tilted down. And what you're trying to do is to take the energy that hits the sidewalls and distribute it back into the seating area. Same kind of thing we're doing off the ceiling, except now we're doing it off the walls. The geometry of getting the sidewall reflections back to the seating area is a little more complicated, but the principle is still the same. This shows the same idea in plan and another variation on doing this kind of thing to try to get strong lateral reflections. Another. Flutter echo. How many people know what that is? Oh, a whole bunch of people. Flutter echoes can be long, can be spaced widely in time, in which case you will hear now, 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 here, here. Or it can be short. You can even hear flutter echoes in your bathroom if you know what to listen for. in a small room, instead of hearing this bap, 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 you'll hear kind of a pring sound if you snap your fingers. Anybody ever heard that? That's usually a flutter echo. It's the equivalent of that funhouse mirror thing where you have two mirrors facing each other and you stand in between and you see a thousand reflections of yourself decreasing in the distance. Same thing happens with sound. Usually that's not a good thing. And it's not always a simple case of two parallel surfaces. It can be two walls, it can be floor and ceiling. Sometimes it can be a focusing surface and a flat surface, or the one I talked about earlier where we had two focusing surfaces staring at each other. These are actually worse because they concentrate the flutter. As it flutters back and forth, the energy actually concentrates and converges to either a line or a point, depending on the geometry. And sometimes you can get this sort of thing, which isn't truly a curved focusing surface, but it still acts that way.
It seems like sometimes I've heard it in non-parallel walls, if they're big enough, they'll flutter also.
It can. Usually that's a compound bounce of some kind. It can take you a lot of staring to figure out which way it's going. Some other interesting shapes. We've all heard the so-called whisper wall effect, which can occur in plan around a curved wall. It can also occur up over the ceiling in a dome or something. And what'll happen is somebody can talk here, and you can hear over here clearly, even though that's 100 feet away and the room is noisy. And it's because the sound is kind of boinky, boinky, boinky going all the way around. Here's a case where you might actually put a thing over the talker. You'll see this often in Catholic churches from a couple hundred years ago to maybe 75 years ago, where they had this funny looking thing over the pulpit. And that was not a decoration, as many people suppose. If you put it at the right angle, it puts some useful reflections from the talker into the audience at the appropriate places. Sometimes you see domes put in places where you don't want them. That almost never provides useful reflections. Okay, room modes are basically when the room is resonating between surfaces. That will happen just like it's an organ pipe. All rooms do this to one degree or another and at some frequencies, at specific frequencies. They're a function of the geometry of the room, not only the shape but the dimensions. And they will develop these resonances as the sound reflections interfere with themselves and create things called standing waves. How many people have ever worked with microwaves and waveguides and antennas and stuff? Same mathematics, same principle, just occurring here with sound. And you've probably heard this where you may have put a subwoofer in a room and you set it up and you turn it on and you're walking around to check the coverage, and you walk right here and it about blows your head off, and then you walk over this way and it's gone. That's a standing wave. That's caused by room modes. In real rooms of practical dimensions, this is usually a low frequency problem. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because this is about a 4-week topic. And there's a couple of other people in the room who are more qualified than me to talk about room modes anyway. But there's three modes where they can occur, which is axial, tangential, and oblique. Axial is the simple case between two opposite surfaces. These are usually the ones that are the strongest and the most troublesome. Tangential is where it occurs with four surfaces. And then oblique is where it occurs with all six surfaces. And that way of describing the phenomenon assumes that the room is a perfect rectangle, and even this room is not a perfect rectangle, but many rooms aren't rectangular, so the truth is more complicated than this. What can you do to control room modes? Well, you can fiddle with the ratios of the dimensions of the room. You can fiddle with the loudspeaker location, assuming that energizing the room with a loudspeaker and the resulting room mode and standing waves that occur are what your problem is. You can move the listener, and you can fiddle with the room finishes with combinations of absorption, reflection, and diffusion, especially diffusion. This is a there's a pretty good chapter on this in Glenn Ballew's book. Actually, he was the editor, not the author, the New Audio Cyclopedia. And this chart is from that that illustrates, and you can't quite see some of that stuff, but the, it illustrates these modes that occur. These strong ones up here are axials, then the tangentials, and a couple of oblique modes down here. And you can see that these are occurring in this particular space from 18 to 45 hertz. These can be very strong, as illustrated right there. I'm sure you've all experienced that, where you walk 6 feet and it goes from being a peak to a very strong null. There's so-called golden ratios of rooms. This is the ratio of length to width, and in some cases height. And people over the years have developed tables of what they call golden ratios. The promise is that if you use one of these, everything will be grand and you won't have any room modes. Not true, but the room modes will be more evenly distributed and less troublesome than if you don't. Nowadays, actually, with computer analysis, these tables are kind of obsolete, but they're still useful in the early planning. This
on that previous slide, what was order? Order. What exactly does that mean there? It says order, length, width.
Oh, order preference.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I should have mentioned that. Yeah, it's order of preference. Yeah. So okay. He thinks this is ideal. This is still pretty good, and in between is in between.
So for number one, theoretically, a room that's 19 feet by 14 feet would be good.
Yes.
Okay. And what about the ceiling? That's
This table doesn't show the ceiling, but you can apply the same ratios, look at either length or width to the ceiling and do the same thing. What you'll find is you end up with fairly high ceilings, and if you try to select an ideal ratio.
So any two perpendicular dimensions?
Yeah. Yeah. In practice, at least in my world, we rarely have the option of selecting a ceiling height. Ceiling height is usually determined by the structure of the building, at least the maximum ceiling height, and that ceiling height is usually too low to take advantage of this. That's not totally true, but another illustration that's similar is this chart. I took this out of Irvine and Richard's book. Roy Richards actually lives here, is a good friend of mine. I was hoping he could be here tonight, but that didn't work out. This table's been around a long time and shows in a graphic format ratios of width and length that are good. And apparently the ideal is right there in the middle.
Are the presumptions here that the walls, the surfaces, are pretty reflective?
It won't matter because this is a low-frequency phenomenon, and even walls that have 4 inches of fuzz on them are still going to be reflective at low frequencies.
How about 14 inches?
Well, I happen to know you're talking about your room, so it's 14 inches helps, but that's still only absorptive, I'm supposing, down to probably 80 hertz. What are you thinking? 80 hertz, 14 inches, so it's still going to be reflective at 20 hertz.
Cellos don't go that low.
And pardon?
Hey, cellos don't go quite that low.
Now, however, cellos go higher than what was indicated on your chart, which was somewhere around 500, and you can actually find a cello note that we've had to play. Around 1,500. Around 1,300.
Get down on the
thread
there.
Yeah, way down there where it's
all
scratchy.
Yeah.
As
I said in the beginning, all of this is grossly oversimplified. Common wisdom is that you can fix the room modes by splaying the walls. We don't think so. That's a really expensive proposition, and my opinion is you're usually better off to spend that money on something else. Splaying the walls doesn't fix the problem, but it does change it. And this is also from the Audio Cyclopedia, and shows at certain frequencies show some room mode problems where these are lines of isobar. And you can see if we take that same kind of a room, this one is at 180 hertz, we take this same basic room and we splay the walls, well, we've changed it, maybe we've made it better, but it's still not all at the same pressure. It's just a different shape. I'm not saying this isn't a useful technique, but architecturally it's horribly expensive and difficult to build, and I'm not convinced that it's a good way to go unless you're Bill Gates and you have more money than you know what to do with. It's also worth noting that some of the most revered concert halls are not built like that. They're classic shoebox shape. They may have some shaping on the walls, but the basic shape of most really good concert halls, the ones that the musicians love, are often a plain shoebox. They're not wedge, they're not anything, they're a plain shoebox. A note about loudspeaker placement, because what many people don't realize, and this illustration is almost identical to the one you'll find in any good book on antenna theory, where they talk about ground planes and all that sort of thing. When you put a speaker in a room, a real room, you don't have one speaker, you have six speakers. You have this one, which is the actual speaker, but then you have another one back here that, if this is 3 feet, then you have a virtual speaker back here at 6 feet whose characteristics are the same as the pattern of radiation off the back of the speaker box. And you have another one over here from the sidewall and another one off this sidewall, which isn't illustrated, and one off the ceiling and one off the floor. Now, how many people were here when Dan did the demonstration of two loudspeakers that were spaced and what happens? Well, now we've got six loudspeakers that are placed. What do you think's going to happen? Not going to sound very good, which is why you don't want specular reflections off surfaces that are near loudspeakers. And you can combat this with combinations of diffusion, absorption, and maybe putting the loudspeaker flush into a soffit or into the wall. That doesn't eliminate all of them, but at least it eliminates one.
Or you use a very directional speaker.
That helps, but only at the high frequencies, because all speakers are omnidirectional at low frequency. Wow, you're a really big horn. Does anybody remember the concrete monster that was illustrated? I'm dating myself again. It was in Audio Magazine, I think about 1960 or 65. Anybody remember that?
The big horns?
Yeah, the big, the low frequency. They were horn-based subwoofers.
Right.
And the mouth was roughly, I think, around 75 square feet. I wanted one of those so bad. My dad wouldn't let me build it. Now my wife won't let me build it. Okay. When you're doing a room, the key decision is what are you going to put on all those surfaces? Not only what shape, but what are all those surfaces going to be? And putting a whole bunch of absorption all over every place doesn't necessarily make it better. Keep in mind that all these absorbing things, these have colorations the same as loudspeakers. So if I try to combat that reflection problem with just straight absorption, where I'm trying to clobber my virtual speakers, those reflections are going to have colorations that I might not like. Okay, now we can take a break. Somebody poke Rick. I caused him to nod off.